Sometimes I land under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true. All right, we are back, folks. Good afternoon, happy Tuesday, and this is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition, where, by golly, today we are going to finish the book of Jeremiah and the final chapter, which is chapter 52. We started on it last week, and we have a little bit to go. Now, admittedly, a lot of this we have talked about before. That's part of the reason why we'll probably do it a bit faster than we have some of the other elements of the book, simply because a lot of this is, in fact, a kind of a summary of things that the book has described in detail earlier. So with any event, what I will do to begin with is I'll say, hey, good afternoon to Ken, and just say quick howdy, and then we'll go to MP, Ken.
Okay, well, howdy to the audience, and I pray everybody's got their thinking cap on, and you will have your book open of scripture, and join us in reading the words and understanding it for yourself. So,
all right,
that's all I have for now.
Very good. That's always good advice. That's usually how we begin with the intro, at any rate, which I will re-record one of these days. However, we also have MP with us online, Mark Patron. And what we'll do is we'll go to Mark Patron first, because I think he is described as tail end Charlie in this case. He's a little bit behind where he wanted to be as far as the commentary on chapter 52. And like I said, then we'll go through and read the rest of it, and we'll eventually move on. Those that are curious, we're going to go to the book of Ezekiel, or Ezekiel, next, and we'll have a lot to say about that. In any case, good afternoon, MP. How are you doing
today?
Take us where you'd like.
I'm doing wonderfully. I'd like to start at verse 8 through 11. If you would like to read that, I'd appreciate that.
All right. Yeah, we'll read that, and then we'll continue. So it says, talking about the fall of Jerusalem, some reviewing again. The army of the Chaldeans pursued the king. They overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. All his army was scattered from him. So they took the king, and they brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah in the land of Hamat, and he pronounced judgment on him. Then the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and he killed all the princes of Judah in Riblah. And he also put out the eyes of Zedekiah, and the king of Babylon bound him in bronze fetters, took him to Babylon, and put him in prison till the day of his death. So, again, we've talked about this before, MP. Go ahead and recap whatever you'd like there.
Thank you. Yeah, in verses 8 through 11, we get a quick telling of the basics of what happened over the next few hours or days. I'm certain that these verses happened in pretty rapid succession. Yirmiyahu had told Zedekiah, that he should submit to Nebuchadnezzar. But Zedekiah thought Yirmiyahu was a spy for the enemy. Well, if Zedekiah thought of Yah as his enemy, he actually may have a point. But Jerry and Yah had only Yehuda's best interest at heart, as Zedekiah, the scheming politician, should have. So Zedekiah ran, Nebuchadnezzar caught up, and Zed's army took a play out of Zed's own playbook and scattered to the winds, while the king was taken prisoner. And that is how Zedekiah saved his men's life. What an example of leadership Zedekiah was. So, the wording is a little hard to follow, but verse 8 ends with Zedekiah's army scattered from him. Then in verse 9, it begins with, they took the king and carried him to the king of Babylon, which sounds as if Zedekiah's own men took him to Nebuchadnezzar in Rivlata Ba'aretz Hamat for adjudication. Hamat is along the northern trade route to Babylon and other points north and then east or west. Now, Riblah was a main city along the route, back towards Babylon, which is where Nebuchadnezzar passed his judgment on Zedekiah. The narrative hints that Neb had been thinking of his punishment for a long time, at least a year and a half. I think that because Nebuchadnezzar had Zedekiah's sons there waiting for the adjudication. So Nebuchadnezzar, number one, brought his son to the court, and number two, had them killed while Zedekiah watched. And then, three, he had Zedekiah's eyes burnt out with a red-hot poker. One, two, three, done. That may have demoralized Zed just a bit, because the last thing he saw before the hot poker that blinded him was the death of all of his sons. And I don't think we're told how much longer Zedekiah lived. I'm pretty sure that Nebuchadnezzar kept him on a suicide watch, not quite like the one Jeffrey Epstein was on. I think Nebuchadnezzar would definitely have kept him alive for a bit and announced it to the world so people would know to not tick him off. That's what I got through verse 11. What do you guys got to say?
Okay.
Anything?
Ken, you got anything else you want to add, or should we continue to read on?
Well, you can go ahead and read on.
Okay, again, a lot of this is another bit of the recap of the history. So now it says, on the fifth month, on the tenth day of the month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard who served the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. And he burned the house of Yahuwah and the king's house, all of the houses of Jerusalem, that is, all the houses of the great, he burned them with fire. And all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down all the walls of Jerusalem all around. Then it says, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive some of the poor people, the rest of the people who remained in the city, the defectors who had deserted to the king of Babylon, and the rest of the craftsmen. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left some of the poor in the land to be vine dressers and farmers. Let me read a bit more here. We'll read some fairly large sections of this. Then I'll go with Ken, and this time. The bronze pillars that were in the house of Yahuwah, and the carts and the bronze see that were in the house of Yahuwah, the Chaldeans broke in pieces, and they carried all the bronze to Babylon. They also took away the pots, the shovels, the trimmers, the bowls, the spoons, all the bronze utensils with which the priests, the Kohanim, ministered, the basins, the fire pans, the pots, the bowls, the lampstands, the spoons, and the cups, whatever was solid gold and whatever was solid silver, the captain of the guard took away. The two pillars, one C, and that's capitalized with a capital S, the 12 bronze bulls which were under it, and the carts which King Solomon had made for the house of Yahuwah, the bronze of all of these articles was beyond measure. Now, concerning the pillars, the height of one pillar was 18 cubits. A measuring line of 12 cubits could measure its circumference. It was big around, in other words. And its thickness was 4 fingers because it was hollow. A capital or a top piece of bronze was on it. And the height of one capital was 5 cubits with a network of pomegranates all around. And the capital all of bronze. The second pillar with pomegranates was the same. There were 96 pomegranates on the sides. All the pomegranates all around the network were 100. And let's break there, and then we'll come back and talk about more having to do with Nebuzaradan. Go ahead, Ken.
Okay, verses 12 to 14, King Nebuchadnezzar's 19th year as king would coincide with Zedekiah's 11th year. And thus, this very well could have occurred 1 month after King Zedekiah's judgment, in which all of Jerusalem was set ablaze, to include the temple, the king's house, and all of the houses of the city. And the army went so far as to break down the walls of Jerusalem as well. So they really made a field day of it, squashed it all, you know. Imagine that, because you know Jerusalem was a beautiful city, and it was pretty much torn down.
About more than one day's work, too.
Yeah, that's right. could have been quite some time. Verses 15 to 16, though all of Yehuda is carried away, as in the times of Gedaliah, we see again Babylon leaving some of the poor behind to tend the land. This is smart in that the poor are made much more prosperous than their previous estate and will be very happy to give back a tax in return. So it sounds like a good business practice with regards to war and its results. So I think that was a smart thing by, and hey, considering Nebuchadnezzar was led by Yah himself, you know, it's no wonder there was some good spoils going on there. Now, verses 17 to 23, as with the spoils of war, Babylon was no exception in that they took all of value back to their home. And you probably can't imagine the wealth in the temple alone and all of the metals that were forged together with such beauty. This temple had been a spectacle for quite some time, in that people from around the world were awed in seeing it. And you know that Yehuda, as the remaining remnant in the land, would have had such wealth accumulated over the years since King David and Shlomo. The enormity and beauty is detailed in these verses to give the reader, yea, to include, yes, to include us in this day, a sense of awe and sorrow in that Yah's people threw all of this away in living out their own desires of greed and wickedness. The bringing down and carrying away the temple is figurative of the destruction and captivity of his people, who certainly deserved what they were getting. So all of this detail, the of the beauty of the different metals, the different parts of the temple, the pomegranates, for example, all of these things were just beautiful pieces that many people cherished, and they were all broken down, taken away. And again, it's figurative of the people themselves being taken away due to their falling away from Yah. So that's what I have through verse 23.
Okay, MP, ready?
All right. Yeah, back to verse 12. Stones Tanakh says that the temple was actually set afire in the late afternoon of the ninth of the month, that was Tisha B'Av, but the fire did most of the damage on the tenth of the month. Now, that makes sense to me. I think that the rabbis are probably closer to on the nose than the treasure of scripture knowledge, which has this. Say, it appears that the parallel passages of Kings, that Nebuzaradan came from Ribla to Jerusalem on the seventh of the fifth month. But it seems that he did not set fire to the temple and city till the 10th day, being probably occupied with the intervening days in taking the vessels out of the house of Yah and collecting together all the riches that could be found. In memory of this calamity, the Jews devoted two fast days, fasts to this day, the 17th of the fourth month, which falls in June, for the destruction of Jerusalem, and the ninth of the fifth month, which falls in July, for the destruction of the temple, both of which were mentioned by Zechariah as kept for this event till his time, a period of 70 years, under the names of the fast of the fourth month and the fast of the fifth month. By the way, this past Shabbat, 9 July 2022, was the ninth of Av. It was the day on which that temple was destroyed. The captain of the guard is translated as Rav Tabach, which he translates as the Lord Butcher. And the root means Lord High Executioner. Not a guy that you want to tick off, I'd say. Second to the king himself, I would think. Now, I think in this case, his duties were as Nebuchadnezzar's Secret Service team leader. Potiphar lived this office for Paro, and it was he who purchased Yosef from the Ishmaelites from Midian in Genesis 37:36. Are we seeing how Tanakh is constantly reiterating itself? It's as if Yah wants us to stop and think. Nah, that can't be it. Can it? Can it? Isn't it interesting that Yah seems to want us to stop and think sometimes? This is why I like TRTT. a TTRT rather. I wrote it backwards. We get to have a couple of great minds and me think out loud. In verse 13, it tells us briefly about the actual burning of Shlomo's temple and the destruction of the city's walls on verse 14. The narrative gives me to think that it was just the Chaldean soldiers who did the wall destruction. I can't imagine that many of Yerushalayim's inhabitants would have helped destroy their beloved city with the wall and Shlomo's temple, even though Shlomo, and presumably the other kings as well, bedchamber was butted up against the wall of the temple. I think the wall of the Kadosh Kedoshim, okay, the Holy of Holies, was directly through the wall of Shlomo's bedroom to the temple. That's what the way I heard it anyway, which I personally think is a little gutsy on his part. Anyway, here's a bit of detail coming up in verse 22. There's a bit of detail coming up in verse 22 that I'll probably discuss at some length, dealing with the length of the chapiters of the pillars that stood before the temple proper. Mark Call may remember the discussion from a couple of years ago. That was a teaser. Now, verses 15 and 16. You may remember the prophecy that came through Yirmiyahu in 15, 1 and 2. It said, Then said Yah unto me, though Moshe and Shemuel stood before me, my mind not toward this people. Cast them out of my sight and let them go forth. And it shall come to pass, if they say unto thee, Whither shall we go? Then thou shalt tell them, Thus saith Yah, such as for death, to death, such as for the sword, to the sword, such as to famine, and such as to captivity, to captivity. Well, that's what's happening right here in 52:15. Whatever the conqueror needs them for is what they are going to do in their soon captivity. Yirmiyahu's prophecy comes to pass again, and in his lifetime. In fact, in just a few years. Hello, prophet. By the way, the same went for Zechariah in 14:2, where he said, For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. The residue of the people will be needed to keep the place viable, but it will be a skeleton crew of sorts. The once great city will not be as she was. In verse 16, it tells us that of what will become of Yerushalayim until such time as Yehuda returns, with, I think, Zerubbabel as their leader. Those left behind in Yerushalayim will tend the crops for their own use and sale, which will probably be quite successful for the few hundred that will likely be left to take care of the land. Here's what Yirmiyahu had to say in chapter 39 and verses 9 and 10. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive into Babylon the remnant of the people that remained in the city, and those that fell away, that fell to him with the rest of the people that remained. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the people, the poor of the people, which had nothing, in the land of Judah, and gave them vineyards and fields at that time. I would assume that in about 35 to 40 years, the returnees will be amazed at what the remnant had been able to accomplish, and if the returnees are smart, they will help to make it better. We shall see when we get there. Anyway, meanwhile, the remnant probably made themselves a decent living off the land and what they could sell to friends, neighbors, and travelers passing through. That's what I got through verse 16. Shall I move on, or do you guys want to comment some?
If you got anything to add, go ahead, Ken, and then we'll move on. Okay, he says move on.
No, I had commented through 23, so go ahead.
Okay.
Okay, then I'll grab another block here. Verses 17 to 23. Here's where the story gets really interesting to me. Okay, the brass pillars, including their chapiters that flank the entry door of the temple, are described in pretty explicit detail, as they were in 1 Kings chapter 7, opening ceremonies, as it were, to Shlomo's temple. In this chapter, we're witnessing the carrying off of anything of value or military use, like the brass. Mark Call, Rob Miller, and I went over this while discussing the destruction of the temple a couple of years ago. This was where I compared the descriptions of the raising of the temple. I used the King James Version's word chapiters to dwell on. Okay, the English word chapiter is ever and always translated from the Hebrew H3805, Chotaret, the capital of a column, which is the female participle of HR, Hebrew root, 8303, Chatar, to encircle. If it were English, a Chotaret might probably be a small female Chatar. Get it? Chotaret. Never mind. Anyway, all kidding aside, the pillars were 30 cubit long brass or copper tubes that were about 5 feet inside diameter. The Chotaret, the chapiters, were built to fit into the hollow brass columns, and they had about 400 brass pomegranates that covered the top of the pillar so that it could not be told that there was a large insert of the chapiter into the top of the hollow pillar, as much as 5 cubits deep. Now, the original pillars for Shlomo's temple are described in 1 Kings chapter 7 and verses 13 to 21, where it says this: King Shlomo went and fetched Hiram out of Tyre. He was a widow's son of the tribe of Naphtali, and his father a man of Tyre, a worker of brass. And he was filled with wisdom and understanding and cunning in the work, to work all works of brass. And he came to King Shlomo and wrought all his work. But he cast 2 pillars of brass of 18 cubits high apiece, roughly 30 feet tall. I'm telling you that. And a line of 12 cubits, did compass them about. And he came and he made 2 chapiters of molten brass to set upon the tops of the pillars. And the height of the 1 chapiter was 5 cubits, and the height of the other chapiter was 5 cubits. And nets of checker work and wreaths of chain work for the chapiters which were upon the top of the pillars, 7 for 1 chapiter and 7 for the other. And he made the pillars and 2 rows round about upon the 1 network to cover the chapiters that were upon the top, which with pomegranates, and so did he for the other chapiter. The chapiters that were upon the top of the pillars were of lily work in the porch, 4 cubits. And the chapiters upon the 2 pillars had pomegranates also above, over against the belly, which was by the network. And the pomegranates were 200 in rows, round about upon the other chapiter. And he set up the pillars in the porch of the temple, and he set up the right pillar and called the name thereof Yachin. And he set up the left pillar and called the name thereof Boaz. Now, when the temple was built and completely finished, the pillars that flanked the entrance of the holy place had chapiters, okay? These were basically solid brass plugs for the top of hollow pillars, okay, that were exposed about 4 cubits, which means that the hollow 30-cubit pillars were filled with 29 cubits of something, and the strings of pomegranates hung down over the top of the chapiter, concealing the last foot that would be exposed without the strings of pomegranates. Okay, you'd be able to see them if it wasn't for the strings of pomegranates. This something that filled the 29 thirtieths of the hollow pillar is proposed to be sand, which would operate in a hydraulic elevator system to escape with the furnishings of both the Kodesh place, where the high priest worked every day, and the Holy of Holies, where he worked only one day per year, on Yom Kippur. This elevator is proposed to have been in the Most Holy.
Okay, when we get back, we'll pick it up there. MP, got a break.
And I pray, don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday the Lord turn around, because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy-to-do. Let's set a light bound by the law. The 613 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua died for me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new. Challenge motion.
All right, we are back, folks. This is the Torah Teachers Roundtable Tanakh Edition, and we may or may not finish Chapter 52. I had hopes, but who knows. In any case, when we went to the bottom of the hour break, MP was talking about some of the detail here, and honestly, heading off in a direction we've been before. It's been a while. It's kind of interesting, but I'm not sure well, anyway, I'll let him continue. But bottom line is, yes, there has been discussion of these sand hydraulics and whether or not the Holy of Holies and various of the temple furnishings could be lowered via these sand hydraulics, and we talked about this at some length when we talked about the construction of the new temple in earlier editions of their show. But anyway, so yes, were the furnishings of the temple hidden underground? Did they go into one of the tunnels and they were removed? Lots and lots of speculation on that score, and I guess that's mostly what we've got. Certainly, I think it's not just possible, but maybe even probable. But at this point, there's probably no way to prove it unless we can find those things. And so far, while I've heard rumors, we haven't seen it. So let's go back to you, MP.
I'm in. You're exactly right, Mark. I mean, there is no physical evidence for this. However, the Babylonians never found the furnishings for the holy place and the Holy of Holies. Okay? And so, where did they go? I mean, those were the things they wanted the most. I mean, it was the God of Israel as far as they were concerned. And they wanted to take him and show him off. Wouldn't let him. He set up that sand hydraulic. I'm almost certain of it, although there is no proof. Anyway, I'm going to keep on with this. Let's see. Where was I? The sand would be emptied from one pillar to raise the sand hydraulic car, for lack of a better term, to be loaded. When that part of the mission was complete, all of the furnishings put into the elevator car, as it were, they would empty the other pillar and the sand of its sand, and the car would be lowered by the same sand hydraulic elevator to be unloaded, and the precious cargo taken to a designated safe space by the same priests. Okay? Now, none of the temple furnishings, were ever found, and each pillar, when Nebuzaradan got there, were laying on their sides. There's only one side on a round object, by the way. And they were hollow and empty. Whether the Babylonians or Yah brought them down doesn't really matter, does it? So, it's plausible, and I think Shlomo was just the guy to figure that whole thing out. That was the smartest guy that ever lived on this earth, I think. Not the most holy, but the smartest. So the Babylonians got to the Temple Mount. They found the holiest empty of any furnishing, and the outer court, probably near the pillars, which were laying on their sides or pulled over by their own means, and had nothing to show for the destruction than a ton of brass, tons and tons of brass, a ton of tons of brass, as it were, which they probably cut up and transported back to Babylon. Maybe they had a ton of mule teams to drag all that stuff back to Nebuchadnezzar. I don't know, but that's what I got through verse...
Well, it sounds like that's what they did. 20, yeah, from the text.
18, I think.
Okay. Ken, you got any other comments, or should we read on?
I had finished commenting through verse 23. Is that where you finished off at, MP?
Well, yeah.
Nope. I finished at about verse 17, but that's okay. We can, you go ahead. They're getting tired of hearing my voice.
okay. Well, you'll have to catch up then quite a bit.
All right. So the people are going to next be taken to Babylon. We know this happened. This is another one of the places where we're getting a recap. The captain of the guard took Sariah, the chief priest, Zephaniah, the second priest, and the three doorkeepers. He also took out of the city an officer who had charge of the men of war, seven men of the king's close associates who were found in the city, the principal scribe of the army who mustered the people of the land, and 60 men of the people of the land who were found in the midst of the city. So he got a lot of folks. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took these and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. Then the king of Babylon struck them and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamat. Thus, Judah was carried away captive from its own land. So again, a recap of the history here of the carrying away of the people into the land of Babylon. Now, by the way, when we get to Ezekiel, that's where it's going to begin, essentially, with his story. These then, it says, are the people whom Nebuchadnezzar carried away captive in the seventh year, 3,023 Jews, and that would be, I would argue, people of the land of Judah, if not the tribe of Judah. In the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar, he carried away captive from Jerusalem 832 persons. In the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive of the Jews 745 person. All of the persons total were 4,600. Now let's pause there, and we'll go to Ken first this time again.
Good move.
Okay. First, we see Babylon's captain, the guard, select a variety of people in different positions to include priests to be brought back to his land and put to death, most likely before the people of the city of Riblah. Then Yirmiyahu makes a note that 3,023 were carried away in Nebuchadnezzar's 17th year, and in his 18th year, carried away 832 persons. Then later, in his 23rd year, he carried away another 745 Jewish captives. And he finally makes note that this totaled 4,600 persons in total. Now, I'm not sure of the importance of any of these numbers, but it's good to see that Yirmiyahu's math capability was not lacking.
Well, understand, Ken, that we see in the book of Numbers, we see a whole lot of numbers, and it has always been consistent and important for the author of Scripture to lay out for us just exactly how many of the people that he prophesied were going to be as numerous as the grains of the sand are still around and where they are and when, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I guess this is very much like that. We have lots of numbers. But anyway, I'm trying to keep this brief so that we can get through the end of the chapter here. So I'm going to go ahead and
I'm
pass
with you.
It
go
on.
Go ahead.
Over.
Okay, you ready?
So, yeah, go ahead, MP.
Okay, beginning in verse 17, which is where I stopped. Verses 17 to 20 are just a list of all the brass that they found on the Temple Mount. There was too much brass to weigh, so they didn't. But beginning in verse 21, the pillars themselves are described. 18 cubits tall, 12 cubits around, 4 fingers thick throughout. I think that means that the diameter of the empty space in the pillar was about 11.5 cubits across. If we multiply that by 30 cubits height, that would be 334.5 cubits, cubic cubits of sand in one of those pillars. That's a lot of lifting and lowering potential. Again, it's plausible. Verses 22 to 23 describe the chapiters and the pomegranates. We've beaten the chapiter pretty much to death, but the pomegranates detail in verse 23 is pretty amazing. 96 pomegranates on a side? Now, how many sides on a circle? You know, the Hebrew word that's translated side is rucha. And the final letter being a non-vowel-pointed he. The Strong's listed pronunciation, ruach, is not correct. Tanakh has a vowel point, has it vowel-pointed, as I read a moment ago, ruchah, which is pointed het, and a non-pointed hey, which means that the hey is silent. If there's an actual Hebrew scholar out there who can explain to me why that silent hey means, or what it means, other than the silent influence of the Ruach HaKodesh, which is all I can think of, I'd love to hear from you. MarketPatron.net, if you got the answer, email me. Now, verses 24 to 26. The captain of the guard, Nebuzaradan, took with him the high priest, Sariah, and his deputy, Zephaniah, and some doormen from the temple. I don't think it's a stretch to think that all of these things that Nebuzaradan was bringing out would be put on display somewhere for the people of Babylon to marvel at and take great pride in. He also brought seven men who were close servants of Zedekiah's. A search must have been conducted by the conquerors for all of these people and things. The scribe, I doubt that they put themselves out there for him to see. The scribe of the Yehudi army, who knew the strength of the reserve militia, he mustered the people, is what it says there, and about 60 likely men who I think looked like they could fight. It sounds like the whole remaining citizenry of Jerusalem. Nebuzaradan took all of these poor schlubs to meet Nebuchadnezzar in Riblah in Hamath. The poor schlubs got to see Nebuchadnezzar, and then be dispatched to their reward. That's in verse 27. Nebuchadnezzar killed them all. Then in verses 28 through 30, Nebuchadnezzar was ticked at Israel at this point. I really understand why. He had done everything he could to make it as easy as he could on them, you know, and they just kept rebelling, and he had to take them out. Anyway, verses 28 to 30. Here we see 3,023 Yehuda taken captive. The word is from the H-1540 gala, which means to expose or to bear. So they were taken and driven away naked. But that didn't assuage Nebuchadnezzar's wrath, for in verse 29 it tells us that he carried off another 832 people in the 18th year. I assume this was the 18th year after the conquest of Yehuda. If that's correct, there must have been an uprising among the Yehudi that irritated Nev. This chapter doesn't try to detail the entire history of Yehuda under Babylonian rule. We're just hitting the highlights. These Jews obviously didn't like being serfs to a master who was hundreds of miles away, because they did it again a few years later. Verse 30 says that in the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar's conquest, Nebuzaradan dropped in again to quell another rebellion of 745 malcontents out of the 4,600 living around Yehuda. The point being that the Yehudi are, by and large, unwilling to live under any kind of tyranny, even one that would be more or less benign without all the insurgency. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't a tyrant until somebody got uppity. Mark Call, Ken and I, wouldn't be around very long under him if he were a tyrant. We'd be the leaders of the insurgencies, don't you see? Anyone who has lived under benign authority and acted for personal liberty for people who rebel against a tyrant or an idiot, which is basically what we're seeing in the United States of America today, a self-serving idiot who is ostensibly in charge, but in fact is just window dressing for the true tyrants, okay? Joe doesn't know what he's doing, but the people that are handling him do. So, that's what I got through verse 30.
Okay.
And I only got like a couple of paragraphs to the end of this chapter.
Okay. Well, with that little encouragement, let's go ahead and read on through the next few verses here. And I'll notice I refuse to bait there. We'll see if we can't continue. Anyway, now it came to pass in the 37th year of the captivity of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, the 12th month, 25th day of the month, that Evil Merodach. That's an interesting way to put it. King of Babylon, in his first year of reign, lifted up the head of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison. So lifted up the head in this case isn't to detach it. It's as we see in, for example, the Numbers when they're going to do a head count or an identification of a specific individual. And he spoke kindly to him, and he gave him a more prominent seat than those of the kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiakim changed from his prison garments, and he ate bread regularly before the king all the days of his life. And as for his provisions, there was a regular ration given him by the king of Babylon, a portion for each day until the day of his death, all the days of his life. So he had a reasonably, sounds like, nice ending. All right, MP, let's go to you first this time.
I was kind of hoping you'd go to Ken first, because I got a little thing from Azamra that I want to share last on this chapter. Okay, so Ken, go ahead.
Sure. And one thing I wanted to jump back at was when you mentioned a word that had the letter hey at the end. And, one thing I've noticed, even in just this scroll of Yirmiyahu since I started in joining with this program, there's been so many different words that I try to point out each time where you'll have a word in the Hebrew, and sometimes you'll have a word, that same word with the letter hey at the end, and it's usually showing a level of completion when there's a hey added at the end. And one thing that I like to even remember when with regards to adding the hey would be to the names Abraham and Sarah, because there you also saw Yah literally insert the letter hey into their names once they were found or deemed worthy, you know.
Absolutely.
So there you see this level of completion as well. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out with the letter hey. It's something that always jumps out at me anyway.
Yeah, you know what? Just a brief comment. That ending letter hey, okay, that isn't vowel pointed. I really and truly think that it's talking about the breath of Yah, and so that's what it's all about. Okay?
Well,
that's why that's done.
The sages even say that essentially what people would do, we see this with the prophets, we see this with some of the others, they would take one or more, never all three, of the consonant sounds in Yahuwah, and they would add that to a name. So Abraham gets the hey, Yahu, Shua, Yahu, Yerme Yahu, Yeshe Yahu. We see lots of examples of things very much like that.
Amen. Okay, so verses 31 to 34, we see that later in Jehoiakim's 20th year of captivity, and now the king of Yehuda, he was brought out of prison and set as a king with a throne above the thrones of the other kings in Babylon. He changed his garments and ate with continual portions the rest of his days. He was afforded this by the king of Babylon, Evil Merodach, if I said that right, Evil Merodach, something along those lines. And this this pretty much concludes Yirmiyahu's scroll. I have to say, I'm kind of glad this was the first scroll that I was blessed in joining you guys with. It's been such an awesome experience going through all of this, and I have to thank you guys too for having me join. And
well, we're honored to have
and
you
being
with
brothers
us.
To me. Okay, but anyway, that's all that I have for the scroll. Go ahead, MP.
Okay, may I go now?
Yeah,
we're really happy to have you again.
Sure.
Really and true. I love having three perspectives on a particular portion of scripture. It's really good. It's one of the reasons I like you in my Pal Talk room too. You bring a different angle that I wouldn't have thought of, and I really do appreciate that coming from you. It really is good. Okay, so verses 31 to 34. things seemed to start looking up for Jehoiakim when Evil-Merodach ascended the throne of Babylon and released the Yehudi kind from prison. Okay, the phrase lifted up the head has the sound of being bad, as in lopping the head off. But TSK has an interesting explanation. It says, they say, this phrase is founded on the observation of those who hold down their heads, and when comforted, or the cause of the sorrow is removed, they lift up their heads. And that's a really good idea, a really good possibility. Here's this guy who was in prison for all of these years. He'd probably be fed bread and water for 3 days, and then he gets a meal, that kind of thing. And then at the end of this new king comes in and lifts his head up. Okay, he brings him out, and he actually has him eating in his palace with him. That's kind of cool. So here's an example of that kind of stuff from Genesis chapter 40 and verse 13. It says, "And it came to pass the third day, Paro's birthday, that he made a feast unto all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief butler and the chief baker among his servants." Okay? Now you see, lifting up the head doesn't necessarily mean removing the head from the shoulders, but raising hope in the mind of the person or persons. In the case of Paro's butler and baker, both were given hope. One was restored, the butler, but the other literally had his head removed from his shoulders. At least the baker got to enjoy a few minutes or hours of undeserved hope. What happened for Jehoiakim was that he was removed from the prison. He sat in the emperor's throne room on a lesser throne in the emperor's presence, which was just a little better than his cell, if you catch my drift. And he got a nicer set of duds than the striped suit, and ate the same food as the emperor did. I mean, this guy really, really showed him great mercy, as it were. He probably got to eat the food first, so the emperor was sure that, but he got a better, much better diet, and probably gained a little weight. Okay, now, that's what I have on the rest of the chapter, but I have this from Zamora and also the rest of us. They say, and I quote, "May Hashem let us witness all of Jeremiah's prophecies of redemption and restoration speedily and in our days. Amen and amen." I hope that is true for all of us, that we see this wonderful stuff happen to us. That's what I got.
Okay.
For this book.
By the way, can I add one thing in real quick here?
Sure.
Because you mentioned these words, Mark, lifting up the head, which in the Hebrew is the Hebrew words nasa et rosh.
Yeah.
Okay. It's funny, if you look at, and I'm gonna read this real quick. If you look at, and this is something I pointed out throughout the years, but a time where I actually believe this is a bad translation of most all translations when you read these words in Midbar, number 1 verse 2, where it's, "Take ye the sum of all the congregation, the children of Israel, after their families by the house of their fathers, with the number of names, every male by their polls." So it starts off with "take ye the sum," and those words, "take ye the sum," are the Hebrew words nasa et rosh.
Yeah, they're wrong.
The exact same Hebrew word. So just consider when you read those words like the Midbar, it may have been lifting up the head people in a spiritual way. It may should have been translated in the Midbar or Numbers 1 verse 2 that are lifting up the heads.
Well, we're at the break. We'll pick it up when we get back. Next book after this.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around, because all my life.
to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true.
For the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more horn, and our children will pay. One day, one day, one day.
Okay, well, we are ready for Ezekiel, the next book, and we've been a long time getting here, and looks like we're going to be a bit longer. I see a note from Ken during the break. Can I finish with a lift up the head, literally in the side, Rosh in the Hebrew, and that literally means Rosh's head. It means lift up what? Well, that's the pointer to the direct object, the head. So, yeah, King James and others in English translate it as do a head count or do a census or whatever, but literally the words mean lift up the head. So he's got another comment. Go ahead, Ken.
Hey, take the head off.
No, I don't see it that way. How I see it, like if you look at the context going on in Bamidbar or Numbers chapter 1, you can see that each individual is being named before everyone.
Yeah, it's a head count. Yeah.
The whole chapter is full of names. And this is lifting up these people. It is lifting up these individuals that are to be heads of the army.
Okay? Exactly. The point is they
so
are heads.
They are literally.
You're right.
I'm sorry? It's
precisely to point out the individuality. And that's the reason why when I talk about it, I always emphasize exactly what you're saying. It is very individualistic, and it is that's why it's such a nice way to translate it, to lift up the head, because that's exactly what is being done. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And not only do you see that context there in Bamidbar, but you actually do see it here in Yirmiyahu 52 verse 31, where Jehoiakim is brought above all the other, or his throne is made above all the other thrones of the other kings. So his head truly is being lifted up above the others. So you can see when you apply it here and there, it actually jives, you know. I just wanted to point that out.
Okay, very good. Well,
very good.
Are we set? Shall we finally begin taking a look at Yezkel, the book of Ezekiel? And let me do this. I'll introduce it, then I'll go to MP. I know he has some comments, probably similar ones to the ones I'm going to make. So I'll try to make them brief. And what we'll do as we enter a new book is often just set out a little bit about the times and the information. So I ask that we don't repeat some of this, but just kind of hit the new stuff. In general, Ezekiel is the son of a priest. He was among those who as we just talked about, were carried off into exile in Babylon. And I'm looking at one of the Pentateuchs and Haftorot at this point that's talking about some of the specifics. But basically, this is pretty well understood. He became one of the spiritual agencies, as they put it, that kept Israel's soul alive during those years of despair. I think that's a nice way to put it. He is at the same time a priest and a prophet. So he is a Kohen. He is a prophet. He's a preacher. He's a preacher. He's a writer. He inspires the nation. He is a pastor to individual souls. And a characteristic feature of his teaching, and I like this too, is, and this fits my reading and understanding, it's his insistence on individual responsibility. And certainly to hear that from a rabbinic source is interesting, because a lot of times the rabbinic sources tend to emphasize the collectivist or the collective responsibility over the individual. So I like that they point out Ezekiel's understanding that we as individuals have responsibility. He is, in fact, a great preacher of teshuva, the idea of repentance, of divine forgiveness for those who in sincerity, and we're going to see this over and over again as we go through the book, they seek the pardon of Elohim. They seek to walk in obedience to him. And here's a reference. We'll get to this in a few weeks. When the wicked man turns away from his wickedness that he's committed, and he does that which is obedient to Torah, lawful and right, well, then he shall save his soul alive. So basically, more than any other prophet, this thing concludes, Ezekiel makes vivid use of allegory, symbol, and parable to illustrate that message. And I think that is, that's a vital point. As we go through it, and we're going to start right off with it. That's why I was talking with the fellows during the break. I would encourage us, I want to try to push here a little bit, that we do as much interaction, truly a round table, during this first chapter as we can, because among all of the writings of Ezekiel, this is probably one of the most vivid, illustrative, metaphorical, allegorical, descriptive, you name it. There's a whole lot going on here, and for the most part, we read it and we go, huh? So let's talk about it, but we're going to see exactly what they're talking about. He makes vivid use of allegory, symbol, and parable to illustrate his message. So there's my introduction. Let's go to MP and let him add his 25 cents worth as well.
Okay, I had a dime's worth anyway. But in the meanwhile, if I say something and you want to stop me to comment, do it.
Okay. I'll try.
All right, so I'm going to open with a Zomer synopsis of the book. Go ahead.
No, I just said I'll try.
Oh, okay, good deal. It's followed by a Zomer's comments on verse 1. Sit back and enjoy the ride. This is going to take a couple of minutes. But anyway, Ezekiel's prophetic ministry, this is from a Zomer now, okay? Ezekiel's prophetic ministry commenced a few days prior to the destruction of the first temple and spanned a period of over 20 years. Ezekiel received Torah from the prophet Jeremiah, and there is a tradition that he was actually his son and was called the son of Buzi because people despised Buz, Yirmiyahu, Radak, on Ezekiel 1:3 in the name of Targum Yerushalayim. And that's kind of interesting, you know, that this Ezekiel may very well have been the son of Jeremiah, and if that's the case, it's going to really open some things up as we go. Anyway, the opening prophecy of the book of Ezekiel, which came to him in Babylon, is dated to 5 years after the exile there of King Jehoiakim in verse 2. This took place 11 years before the destruction of the temple. Ezekiel went into exile with Jehoiakim, together with sages and prophets like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariahu, and Mordecai. It is surmised that Ezekiel began to prophesy prior to leaving the land of Israel in accordance with the principle that the Shekinah does not rest upon a prophet outside the land unless it first rested on him in Israel. That according to Moed Katan 25a. Now, some hold that Ezekiel's first prophecy is contained in chapter 2, while others hold that it is in chapter 17. Now that's Rashi on Ezekiel 1:3. Okay, in verse 1 it says, "And it was in the 30th year." Our commentators, this is still from Azamra now, our commentators prove that Ezekiel is dating his prophecy to the 30th year since the previous Yovel, that is the Jubilee year, which was the year in which Hilkiyahu, the high priest, found the Torah scroll in the temple in the 18th year of the reign of King Josiah. They tell you where to look for all that stuff, 2 Kings 22:8, 1 Chronicles 34:14, and other ways. Now, although this led to the spiritual revival for a time, it also marked the sealing of the decree of destruction and exile. Thus, Ezekiel tells us that when he received this prophecy of the departure of the Shekinah from the temple, he was already in exile. Much of his prophetic mission was to rebuke the wicked people of his generation for the sins that were to lead to the destruction of the temple and the subsequent exile of the rest of the people. He also prophesied against the nations about going to war with Gog and Magog. However, I'm sorry, However, the climax of his ministry came in the 25th year after our exile in Ezekiel 40 and verse 1. This was the next Jubilee year, according to Rashi, when he had a vision to be taken back to Jerusalem, where he saw every detail of the future temple, prophesying the final restoration of Israel at the end of days, and the order in which Melech HaMashiach, the Kohanim, Levites and 12 tribes will dwell in the land forever. Then it says, by the river Kivar in verse 1. If the Shekinah does rest on the prophets outside of the land of Israel, it speaks with them only in a place of purity over the water. That's from Mechiltah Bo, and tells you to confer with Daniel 8:2 and 10:4. Some identity of the river Kivar identify rather the river Kivar with the Euphrates. The Hebrew word Kivar means already, implying that Ezekiel saw this vision in his vision existed long before, and the letters of Kivar are the same as the word Rekhev, a vehicle, root of the word Merkava, chariot, for in his vision, Ezekiel saw the divine chariot. Now, verses 1 to 3, this is going to be me. That was all of Zamra. In verses 1 to 3, we get a pretty good intro into the chapter, the setup for the rest of the book. And the 30th year tells us that Yehuda had been in Chaldea for 29 plus years, in the 30th year, not the 29th or 31st. By the time that Zeke started to write down his prophecies and the accompanying activities in Babylon, the book opens with a prophetic vision. The biblical writers didn't reckon time the same way that we do. Biblically speaking, we began our first year the moment we breached the matrix and took our first breath. I am in my 69th year of air-breathing life, having ended my 68th year the day before the 68th anniversary of my live birth. You get that? Okay. So I am now in my 69th year, and when I finish this, then I will go into my 70th. I will not be 70 full years on the earth until I get to my 71st birthday. That's how that all works. And that's how the scripture works. When it says in his such and such year, he's in that year. He hasn't completed it yet. Now, the U.S. government used to recognize this biblical timing with their draft registration laws. On my 18th birthday, I registered for the draft, which made me eligible for the draft on my next birthday, which began my 20th year of air-breathing life. The same is true in the Wilderness Army of Israel, where, Numbers chapter 1 and verses 1 to 3. And Yah spake unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of the congregation, on the first of the second month, in the second year after we were come out of the land of Egypt, saying, take ye the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel after their families, by the house of their fathers, with the number of their names, every male by their polls, from 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go to war in Israel. Thou and Aharon shall number them by their armies. That may be the only law on U.S. books that actually follows the way scripture counts time, or anything else. Zamra has a note on verse 3. And there the hand of Hashem was upon him. Every time the word hand is used in the work, in this work, or anywhere else in connection with prophecy, it is an expression indicating force. Prophecy overwhelms the prophet despite himself, similarly to the way in which madness takes over the madman. That's from Rashi that they're quoting. And I'm good through verse 3.
Okay.
And actually,
ahead.
MC, could you read verses 1 through 3 for us?
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. We didn't actually do that, did we?
He did. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, I didn't. I didn't read it yet.
I think you did.
No, I didn't. Anyway, it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Kibar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of Elohim. On the fifth, and it doesn't actually have the word day in here. Some of these times it's in italics, so they assume it's the day. On the fifth of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiachin's captivity, the word of Yahuwah came expressly to Ezekiel the Kohen, the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kibar, and the hand of Yahuwah was upon him there. Let's pause at that point. We'll come back and we'll talk about what he saw in a second. Go ahead, Ken.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
I got about 10 minutes. The scroll of Ezekiel opens with an exact date of when during captivity these events transpire. Now, this appears to be in the 30th year of captivity, which coincides with King Jehoiakim's fifth year as king of Yehuda. And at this time, he is sitting by the river Chebar, which present maps show to begin and end with the river Euphrates. And thus, it's a small branch off of the much bigger river, the Euphrates. And in a section of the land of the Chaldeans, which is just southeast of the city of Babylon. So we must keep in mind, since we just finished up with the scroll of Yirmiyahu, that both it and the scroll of Ezekiel actually overlap a bit. Though Ezekiel starts about 30 years later than the starting of Yirmiyahu, and ends nearly 15 years later than Yirmiyahu ends. And though Yirmiyahu spanned about a 40-year period, Ezekiel spans barely over 20. But unlike Yirmiyahu, or his scroll, we can tell, actually, I'm sorry, not the scroll, but he himself, unlike Yirmiyahu, we can tell right from verse 1 and beyond here in Ezekiel that we are reading from a prophet that is much more spiritually connected to his creator than Yirmiyahu was. At least that's how I see it. Because verse 1 starts off with the heavens being opened and visions being presented from Yah. Now, in searching scripture for the words heaven and opened, I find only 3 additional occurrences of this, all of which are in the Brit Chadashah, believe it or not. And note these 3. One is Matityahu, or Matthew 3, verse 16, where it's written, "And Yehoshua, when he was baptized, went up straightway out of the water, and lo, the heavens were opened unto him, and he saw the Spirit of Yah descending like a dove and lighting upon him." Wow. Mark 1, verse 10, "And straightway coming out of the water, he saw the heavens open, and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him." And finally, Acts 7, verse 56, "And said, Behold, I see the heavens open, and the Son of Man standing on the right hand of Yah." Now, though Matthew and Mark verses are pointing to the same event, we readily see that all occurrences, including Ezekiel here, reveal spiritual events taking place, meaning visions, really. They're all visionary. Right. Thus, the heavens opening can also be considered a spiritual eye-opening or a spiritual understanding made known. Okay? Now, in thinking this way, I can't help but connect or consider about this what some call the third eye, the chakra, also known as the ajna. This chakra is said to be located in the center of your head, parallel to the middle of your eyebrows, and believed to be linked to perception, awareness, and spiritual communication. It may also have something to do with the pineal gland, which is deeply centered in the brain. Now, it secretes melatonin, which is a hormone that helps regulate circadian rhythms. In any case, I don't believe we fully use, if at all, this third eye, whereas it may have been much more in use or prevalent back a couple of thousands of years. And since we see that Yah's hand was on Ezekiel at this time, one can only imagine what sense or senses were in full effect during this event. So, to me, this man is a very spiritual priest and prophet, unlike, not quite like Yirmiyahu. And I'm very excited after reading these first 3 verses, and I sure hope that our readers are as well, and they'll thoroughly divulge themselves into this scroll, as we will do. So join us, please, there, audience. And that's what I have through verse 3.
Okay. MP, you got anything else before we move on?
No. We can move on to 4 and 5 if you'd like.
Okay, let's read a bit more than that. What I want to do is not just dive into the verses specifically, but I want to try to paint the picture here. And I will suggest that there are there's a whole lot of interesting graphics, visuals that are being painted, and that's at least what we want to try to give the our perceptions about. I don't know that we can do a whole heck of a lot more than that. Actually, we can certainly talk about what other people have said this means, but here we go. So the word has come to him. Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also from within it, the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. All right, now here we go. That's about where it ends, because these aren't going to be like men that we've seen. Each one of them had four faces, and each one had four wings. Their legs straight, and the soles of their feet like the soles of calves' feet. Now I'll pause here and say, okay, this is one thing we can say. Calves' feet, at least scripturally, the characteristic that we know about them is that they are cloven-hooved. So they have two hooves and a split. By the way, that makes them kosher, clean animals, too, unlike men, interestingly. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. The hands of a man under their wings on their four sides. Each of the four had faces and wings. Their wings touched one another. The creatures didn't turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each one had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side. And each of the four had the face of an eagle. I'm assuming that's on the opposite side from the man, right? That's the one that's left. These were their faces. Thus, their wings stretched upward. Two wings of each one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. And as each one went straight forward, they went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. And let me go about two more verses. We'll have a fairly complete description of these living creatures. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of the torches going back and forth among living creatures. The fire was bright, and out of the fire went lightning. And the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Now, as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their workings, like the color of beryl, all four had the same likeness, the appearance of their working, as it were, a wheel in the midst of a wheel. So I will occasionally reference Ezekiel's wheel within a wheel. Here's where that reference comes from. And a wheel within a wheel is kind of a fascinating, what would the word be, an analogy or a picture in itself. All right, when they moved, they went towards any of the four directions. They didn't turn aside as they went. As for the rims, this is the rims of the wheels, it sounds like, they were so high that they were awesome. And their rims were full of eyes all around the four of them. When the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. And when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Wherever the Spirit wanted to go, they went, because where the Spirit went, the wheels were lifted together with them. And for the Spirit of the four living creatures was in the wheels. All right, let's pause at that point. So that's 20 verses. Ken, we'll go to you first. And I'm going to just put it this way to start with. What do you think he's describing here? Obviously, the description is very detailed. And it's not like any creatures we've seen, except for the pieces that he describes, are like living creatures. But certainly the combination isn't. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, I was hoping to really slow down on each verse because there's so much we need to look at and compare.
Well, that's fine. What I want to do is talk about it and discuss and try to make so let's do it this way. We have and here I'll digress for just a second. Yours truly, for those that haven't figured it out by now, I'm a big picture kind of guy. I like to look at the big picture. Others the details. So we'll try to do both. After the bottom of the hour, it turns out.
Don't take me soon, cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So my negativity surrounds, I know someday, either love turns around, we go.
Do-do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keeping Torah's a joy to do. They said that I'm bound by the law. The 613 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? Yeshua, double me and you. I keep the peace. Shabbos too. 6,000 years old, it's not new.
All right, we are back, folks. Last segment for today of the Torah Teachers Roundtable. We have just begun to tap into the book of Ezekiel, and obviously we're not going to get very far. We're going to come back to this, and I know that Ken, for example, is going to tell me, I think Ken is going to be an ST-type personality. He wants to look at the details, and I agree, we're going to look at the details, but I wanted to at least start by taking a look at the bigger picture. There is a very colorful description here of these four living creatures and lots of things that are going on. They're going to set the stage for some things that are to follow, but I want to at least just ask some questions as we start thinking about what's being described here. What's the bigger picture? And again, Ken's going to go through some of the details. So with that on the table, I'll let him describe it however he wants and go wherever he wants, and hopefully we'll talk about what it is that these things are and what they are, what the point that they're trying to make is. Go ahead.
Okay, well, let me start with verse 4, where we begin with a whirlwind, okay? There are 24 or so instances of this word whirlwind in the Hebrew. The word sa'ar or sa'ara with the hey at the end, Strong's number H5591. Only a handful of these have a second Hebrew word combined, which is the word ruach. Strong's number 87307. Now, though ruach can often be translated as simply wind, it also can be translated as spirit.
And
in this case, I think both fit quite nicely.
You bet.
And this whirlwind. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's the only point I would make, is there are so many places where the same word in Hebrew can get translated into English as two different words. But the real point I will suggest is it is the same word. And there is a combination there. There's something about the root word in the Hebrew that means both, that if we translate it as one or the other, we maybe miss part of the point.
Right. And like in this case, you're actually seeing two different words, not just one. And that's why I wanted to point this out, because the word ruach is attached to this other word, sa'ar. Okay? So this whirlwind, which appears as a great cloud, bright and including fire, and even seen with the color amber within, is detailed mostly throughout this chapter as having these four entities seen and heard within. Okay, so I just wanted to clarify that with the whirlwind. Now, verse 5, just as they appeared to be four entities, these entities had the appearance of a man. Now, this may be important in that no matter how odd the characteristics are of these four entities, which may not coincide with characteristics of a man, this vision is specific in specifying a man for a good reason. Now, consider the fact that man was spiritually created in the appearance of Yah, but after sin fell upon mankind, man was created in the image of Adam. Now, I believe this to be not only a physical thing, possibly detailing that there was no light covering them as a garment anymore, but also in that man had a spirit that was of his or her own that would begin in this world as tending to one's own flesh, meaning, you know, when you first are born into this world, You tend to begin learning about yourself, about your own flesh. And I think even, Psalm 51 kind of points that out, from the womb. I believe a man's purpose in life is to learn how to become a spiritual entity and begin to choose this path and walk as such. So this makes man different from the other entities that existed in a time of creation, you know, when you're considering or thinking back to the garden, you know, when Yah first made man and he put him there, and these, all that were around him were different. He was one of a kind, most definitely. And of course, that's why Chawa or Eve had to be created as well. So he wasn't, I believe, so alone, you know, in his creation. So this is what might be different in how these four entities appeared, even though many of their physical characteristics were not of a man, such as these different faces, okay, the fact that he has these entities have wings, you know, things like this, okay? Now, verse 6, I can't help but notice this continued theme of fours, okay? We have four entities, each having four faces, and each having four wings. Now, the first instance of this word four, arba, in the Hebrew, Strong's number H702, was the water leaving the Garden of Eden and branching into four. Each of these four branches are partings, or partings, I should say, were unique in name and location. So thus, this branching or severing can be seen in these four entities in that each face, for example, was a different creature. Even the wings were divided into function, two being purposed for covering and two being purposed for flying or moving. I'm still wondering why there were four of these entities to begin with, but I'm sure he will reveal this to me when the time is right. So I'm going to leave it at that through verse 6 for MP. Go ahead, MP.
All right. I'll start here in verse 4. Azamra has a good comment on verse 4. It's pretty lengthy, so hang in there for a second. This will take about a minute and a half. And I looked, and behold, a storm wind in verse 4. It is proper to approach the study of Ezekiel's vision with deep awe and trepidation, because he unveils some of the most profound secrets in God's providence over creation through the divine chariot. Ezekiel had his vision of the heavenly order through which God governs the world on the very threshold of the destruction of the temple. What he saw was the chariot on the throne of glory of the Shekinah. And because it was coming with fury to destroy Israel, it appeared in the form of a storm wind and a cloud. That, according to Rashi, who is a very deep spiritual thinker, not on verse 4. Now, Ezekiel saw it coming from the north because it was coming from the land of the Chaldees, which is in the north, that according to Jeremiah 1:14. And why did it go there? In order to bring the entire world under the dominion of Nebuchadnezzar, so that no one would be able to say that he delivered his nation Israel into the hands of a lowly people. That according to the Haggadah 13:2. Now, here's Mark. Yechezkel says that in the 30th year, I assume, of Yehuda's exile, fourth month, that would be the month of Av, on the fifth day of the month, the anniversary will be this coming 2 August 22, okay, a couple of weeks, the priest Ezekiel had a vision in which the heavens were open to his sight, and he received visions from Elohai, our Elohim, or actually my Elohim, I should say. Yehoiachin, that is, Yah will erect, saw a hurricane or a tornado coming from the north. Scythians, Greeks, Parthians, probably the Nebuchadnezzar and his guys, that looked like a fire folding in on itself in verse 4. That's what that is talking about, or it says, the whirlwind, okay? It's enfolding itself, it says in the King James Version. A fire enfolding itself. That's what it's talking about. The only thing that looks as if it's giving up anything, is the Kashma'al. Stone's Tanakh has this note. It says, according to the sages, the Kashma'al is a type of angel that is at times quiescently stands, that is, hash, and at times speaks, mem malayim, okay, God's praises, okay, so it's, that's what we're talking about. This is an angel that's singing Yah's praises. Again, Azamra has a good comment on the chayot, or the chariots. Ezekiel has the good comment, has a good comment on the chayot chariots. Ezekiel was to see further details of the divine chariot in later visions, in chapter 8 and verse 1, and chapter 10 and verse 1, and others. He would then see the divine presence withdrawing stage by stage from the Holy Temple in Jerusalem prior to its destruction. However, the main focus of the vision in our present chapter is not upon the extraneous fury that was to bring this about, but rather upon the inner workings of the heavenly order of angels, the chayot, the beasts, literally vital beings, and orphanim, wheels, through which God governs the creation. That it was from out of the midst of the storm wind, the cloud and fire, that Ezekiel saw the chayot, in other words, he caught a glimpse of the interiority that lay beneath the external storm wind. He looked inside the storm, is basically what he was saying, and that's what he was seeing, and it was a marvel to him. That's what he was talking about in verse 3 and 4. So, that's what I got for that.
Okay.
You're up, I guess, Ken.
Okay, that was through verse 6 there, MP?
Through verse 4 for me.
Well, I finished through verse 6. So did you?
Okay,
have
well, in that case, let me do that too.
Okay.
And this will cover what I've got for today. Verses 5 and 6 continues the description of the fire. Also, out of the midst thereof, seems to be a continuation of the thought from verse 4. It seems there was one likeness of four living beasts, as if each beast had the body of a man. But in verse 6, it had four faces, each facing a different way, and four wings. I am imagining that each beast could see in all directions and act or react on or to any eventuality. It would be handy to be able to see 360 degrees without mirrors, which this creature could, and to react to in an atomic moment, in the twinkling of an eye. Here's Azamra on the beasts, the chayot. They say, these chayot, the beasts that draw the divine chariot, are described in verses 5 through 12. From Rashi's careful textual analysis, it appears that there are four overall chayot, each of which has four faces, that of a man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle. And each of its four faces, in turn, consists of all four faces. Thus, each chaya has 16 faces, and since each face has four wings, each chaya has 64 wings, that according to Rashi in verse 6. Where he saw that, I don't know, but he had a much deeper mind than I have. Anyway, this suggests that God's providence may be seen as a hologram in which each part contains the whole and each aspect includes all of the different aspects. Ain't nothing gets by Yah Elohim is what that means. In verse 6 says that each has four faces and four wings. TSK has an interesting note. These living creatures were probably hieroglyphical representations of the holy angels, the attendants of the King of Glory, and the ministers of his providence. They were four, apparently to denote that they were employed in the four corners of the world, and they had the likeness of a man to signify that they were intelligent and rational creatures. Can you see how differently the church and the synagogue see things? TSK says that the chayot are probably artist depictions of supernatural beings, while the rabbis see the vision as a vision of actual angelic beings presenting themselves to reinforce whatever idea or circumstance Yah desires to show the prophet, and through him or her, the people. Of course, even the church has some things that to just a guy might seem outlandish, like this. This is from Revelation chapter 4. Verse 6, "And before the throne, a sea of glass, like unto crystal, and in the midst of the throne, and round about the throne, four beasts, full of eyes before and behind. And the first beast like a lion, and the second like a calf, and the third had the face of a man, and the fourth like a flying eagle. And the four beasts each had each of them six wings about and full of eyes within. And they set rest not day and night, saying, Holy, 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 Yah El Shaddai, which was and is to come. And when those beasts give glory and honor and thanks to him that sat on the throne, who liveth forever and ever, the 24 elders fall down before him that sat on the throne and worship him that liveth forever and ever, and cast their crowns before his throne, saying, Thou art worthy, Yah, to receive glory and honor and power. Thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure were they created." But the Chumash has no problem with that, do they? I'm sorry, the church has no problem with that, do they? Did you get all that? I mean, that was some really mystical stuff we're looking at right there, and the church doesn't have any problem with that. But they got a problem with these chariots and all that stuff being representations of God. Okay, so back to another comment from Azamra.
Hold on just a second, Mark. I gotta admit, you lost me there when you were talking about the church and the problem. Try that again, because I didn't follow where you were headed with that.
Where I was headed with that is that the church says that that all of these things that are going on in Ezekiel and Yirmiyahu and all those other places, the places where people are having visions, they see it as a load of garbage, okay? And they won't handle it like that. But then you see this thing in Revelation that's even wilder in my eyes, and they readily accept it because it's in the New Testament, not in the Old. And that's the issue. The church refers to the Old Testament once in a while to kind of back up things that they see in the New. But they don't really believe what's in the Old Testament. They really don't. At least I'm finding that they don't, you know. So that's where I'm coming from.
Okay. Now I understand where you were headed. That's what escaped me the first time. All right, Ken, why don't you take it where you'd like then?
Okay. Let me jump on verse 7 here. This may end up taking us out. So verse 7 was about their feet were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of a calf's foot, and sparkled like the color of burnished brass. I think it's important that Ezekiel's word shows differentiation between what we are perceiving as the whole foot and the sole of the foot. Now, in spiritual understanding, one's walk has to do with one's righteousness, in which walking straight is figurative of walking in his ways. And the word straight in this verse is the Hebrew word yashar, Strong's number H3477. Interestingly enough, this word is not introduced in Scripture first until Shemot or Exodus 15:26, which provides us with these words, and said, "If thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of Yahuwah thy Elohim, and wilt do that which is right in his sight, and wilt give ear to his commandments, and keep all of his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am Yahuwah that healeth thee." If one considers Job as the oldest text in Scripture, then this would be the first instance of this word, yashar, but rendered as upright. This is Job 1 verse 1. "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was perfect and upright, one that feared Elohim and eschewed evil." If I said that right. Eschewed evil.
Correct.
In either case, we can see the spiritual connection with this word vice, our possible understanding of a physicalness of walking straight, neither to the left nor to the right. But even with this idea of not turning to the left or right, I like to recall this good verse of his, which is Debarim or Deuteronomy 5 verse 32. Ye shall observe to do therefore as Yahuwah your Elohim hath commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And thus I believe these entities to be doing exactly as Yah prescribed. Or prescribes, being good and faithful servants as a good man should in walking straight. Now regarding the sole of the foot, likened to the palm of the hand, okay, this is the part of the foot that makes contact with the earth or whatever else is being walked upon.
Well, time out.
And these are... Go ahead.
Okay. You say palm of the hand, which verse are you looking at here? That's verse 7, right?
Yes, verse 7. We're looking at this word soul, which is the Strong's number 3709, the word kaf.
Okay, now, that's kaf translated in the English I'm looking at as
rendered,
calf.
Oh, go ahead.
The word is translated in my English version here. I'll go to the Hebrew in a second because I don't have it sitting here, but it's translated as calf's feet, i.e. a cow. And that kind of a hoof, as opposed to what you're suggesting.
Right.
I'm not suggesting anything. I'm reading the word sole of the feet. The word sole is the word kaf, which is either a sole
right.
of a foot or the palm of a hand.
That's
what this word sole is.
The part about calves.
Okay.
The part about calves' feet is what I'm talking about. You don't have that
right.
in your memory.
I haven't gotten that far yet. I'm only talking about the part of which is the sole of it, okay? The sole. not the whole foot. Like we see earlier in this verse where it says, and their feet were straight feet. That's one concept. Now we have the sole of the feet. Okay?
Right.
Not the whole foot, but just the sole.
Do you have the word
the
calves?
Soul.
Does the word cow feet appear in your translation?
Yes, it does. I'm just not there yet.
I'm talking
about this.
That's where I was confused.
The sole of the foot.
You mentioned palms.
Okay.
Okay. And I thought you had something completely
yes.
different there.
No. Just the word soul, which is whether it's the soul of these entities' feet or the soul of a calf's foot, is still the soul of the foot. Okay. And the soul is the part of the hand or foot that literally makes contact with something.
Okay, so far
okay?
so good. No problem.
That's the difference in the... Yeah, that's the difference in the whole foot or just the sole of it, okay? Let's see. And these are likened to a calf's foot. A calf, which is the Hebrew word egel in the Hebrew, Strong's number H5695, is known to be a young cow to grow up into a bull, okay? This is a creature that is still in a learning phase. It's also used specifically in what Yisrael built to worship when Moshe first led them into the wilderness, in which Yah was greatly displeased. And in my reasoning, we see the color of the sole of this foot being brass, which brings my mind to the outer parts of the tabernacle that pertain to those people who come to the tabernacle in sin, but seeking to draw near unto Yah. So such parts that were made of brass were such things as the laver or laver, various vessels, parts of the columns, parts of the altar. The differences between the metals of gold, silver, and brass or bronze were spiritually significant.
All right, well, we're at the end of the show, and like it or not, that's significant too. So we'll pick it up next time in the rest of Ezekiel chapter 1. Shalom, folks.